Dave Ross with Heather Bosch, who's in for Colleen, and Chris Sullivan. He's only been here 6 years, but as Steve Mylette leaves as Bellevue's police chief today and heads out for his next adventure, he says he feels a sense of pride, along with one big regret. Chi Radio's Hannah Scott got a chance to sit down with the chief before he leaves.
Steve Mylette wraps up his 6 years of service as Bellevue's police chief today in what would best be described as a bittersweet moment, a sense of sadness, both from the chief and city leaders who lured him here from Texas 6 years ago, but at the same time, a sense of hope and excitement for the next challenge for Mylette and for his boss's certainty that Mylette is leaving the Bellevue Police Department in a much better state than he found it.
I am so proud of, and I know this sounds cliche, but I am very, very sincere when I say this. I am so proud of the men and women that I get to interact with here in the police department every single day. We're not perfect, but the heart of the police officers in the city of Bellevue is noble, and they come out to serve the public every single day with a selfless attitude and looking to help people. And the culture that's within this police department, I'd put it up against any other. I would. Now, again, we're not perfect. And yes, we are going to have that employee, hopefully on rare occasion, do something that they shouldn't do. And then we'll deal with it and we'll hold them accountable. But the men and women of this police department, sworn and civilian, contributes to making this place very special.
Among Mylette's victories here in Bellevue, focusing on community, transparency, as he entered the job amid a rocky era of police misconduct. But then, in his initial year here, Mylette and other city leaders created the Tomorrow's Program.
The signature program that we developed early on when I got here and continues to thrive in this police department is the Tomorrow's Program, where we look at community engagement as our opportunity and our responsibility to effectively serve the people that we're sworn to serve, looking for every opportunity to engage with the community. And, you know, we created the Sector Captain Program, the 7 advisory councils to the chief of police, working with community leaders, coming up with town hall forums and safety forums, everything that we've done to keep the community informed on what their police department is doing.
The second pillar of the Tomorrow's Program, process improvement.
Looking for every opportunity to strengthen our systems of service here in the police department, working to ensure that we're furthering the vision of the city council and the work of the city manager and the rest of the city team. And again, there's multiple things that I can point to as components of that. And then the last pillar is employee engagement, employee wellness, and employee development. Because if you don't invest in ensuring that you have healthy employees, and I'm talking physical well-being, mental well-being, emotional well-being. If you don't invest your resources into that, then you're going to put officers at a disadvantage going out there to serve.
Now, Mylette believes in going after the criminals, but he also believes that policing is something that needs to be ever-evolving. And most importantly, he focuses on police having a role to play in serving the community and treating that community with respect, as we saw last year, as protests and looting over the death of George Floyd ripped through downtown Bellevue. At the center, Chief Mylette sitting down with the angry community.
And, of course, the people in our communities want to be heard. They want to be treated fairly. They want to have confidence that the systems that impact them are going to treat them equally. And at least here in the city of Bellevue and the police department that I have the privilege of leading, we all are on the same page with that.
And as far as moving on from this beloved community, for Mylette, it has nothing to do with protests or policing laws and everything to do with family.
Long term, I want my children close to me and my grandchildren. And, you know, Joanna's put up with me and my profession and all the demands on it. She deserves it. So when Akron came available, I looked at it. Community looks like it's a wonderful community. I flew out there before I even applied and interacted with the people who live there, and just wonderful people, very welcoming, very friendly. And, you know, the opportunity for my children to be able to thrive here is a challenge, to say the least. And I know most people realize that. The cost of living here is just crazy.
Boy, we're going to miss him. Hannah, what was his biggest regret?
His biggest regret was the case of Sky Metawala, a little boy who disappeared before he was even working here. If you remember that case, that was the mom who was, I think, separating from the dad, and she had been driving around and said she ran out of gas or had some car trouble and decided to walk and left her 5-year-old in the back seat. When she got back, he was gone. She had some international ties and was very uncooperative, and there was literally nothing they could do about it. So he made one more plea on his way out the door for her to cooperate and speak to investigators. That was his biggest regret. But he really has transformed what had been a somewhat problematic department and inspired, really, not just his local law enforcement in Bellevue, but much of the law enforcement around the state.
Well, I remember him sitting down with the protesters last summer, and in listening to your interview with him, I was saying to myself, you know, it sounds like all this reimagining of the police has already gone on in Bellevue. So why don't they just come? I mean, we're struggling. What's the secret to policing? Who's done this? This is right across the lake.
Yeah,
why don't they just contract with him?
I don't know the answer to that. I can tell you he's got some significant concerns about the new laws. It's mostly that his sense is that they were somewhat rushed, you know, in the legislative process. When there's a big kind of movement and then they want to get some things passed, they do it quickly and then they fix it after. And that's a dangerous position to put the police officers in. And he's concerned about that. But on the whole, he very much believes that there does need to be an involvement and a change in some of the things we see in policing. So, I'm with you. I think perhaps a meeting with Steve could have helped a little bit.
Yeah. I know there's some people who hear me say that and say, well, everybody over there is white. No. I don't know how long it's been since you visited Bellevue, but it's one of the most and you know, we're talking about Microsoft and Google and Facebook and Expedia and companies like that. But I mean, it's a remarkably diverse city now.
It really, really very much is. And I think when we talk about people of color, there's a very large Asian community in Bellevue, and then but there's also, you've got Black people, Hispanic people, and a very, very diverse neighborhood, and he's been able to do that. And if you I will really never forget on May 31st, like you said, when he was sitting down and talking to these protesters who were so angry. I don't know if you remember how angry there was. Different groups, right?
Well, and they took off into Bellevue Square, right?
Right, yeah. And it was the same day that we saw Seattle downtown being torn apart, and there was a lot of rumor going around about what might be happening, what the plans were going to be as far as those protest type folks were concerned. And it was just one of the most moving things and impressive things I've ever seen for him to sit and engage with them as long as he did. And I think if everyone could do that and listen and be patient with one another on all sides, we might get somewhere.
Amen. Good luck to him. And thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Wild horses have roamed the American West for centuries. Now, one photographer is on a mission to save these iconic animals. CBS's Chip Reed has your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Heritage Homecraft.
Mary Hone is a longtime wildlife photographer, but about 5 years ago, it was America's horses who stole her heart.
The more time you spend with them, the more in love you get with them. I want people to know what it's like to see these horses and to experience these horses. I want them to have that connection with the horses that I feel.
She roams the West in her RV, photographing the horses, selling her work at art shows, and giving some of the proceeds to charities that protect them.
Why are you so passionate about wild horses?
You just feel such a connection with them. Their souls are just so wonderful.
But in a long-running dispute, ranchers say there are so many horses, they're ruining federal grazing land. The federal government agrees and has resumed helicopter roundups that force the horses into holding pens, which Hone describes as brutal. A small number are injured and have to be put down.
Their life is just heartbreaking.
Hone's hope is that her art will change some hearts.
They need our voices. They need us to fight for them. I will never stop fighting for them, ever.
Fighting for this iconic symbol of the American West. Chip Reed, CBS News.
And now here he is, filling in on the Gene Ursula Show, the man of a thousand voices, Aaron Mason.
I'll use this one, Dave Ross. Hello.
It sounds pretty good to me.
Thank you.
All right. I am hearing all this bafflement.
Yeah.
About the new guidance recommending that even vaccinated people return to wearing masks indoors. Are you baffled by this?
Yeah, disappointed, probably. Yeah, I'm shocked that here we are again. Here we go again. You know, we had a chance to really...
So you're simply baffled by the situation. You're not confused by the decision to
no, well,
request
I mean,
it, this.
My only bafflement is between the idea that, well, we'd really like you to do this if you want, please, versus like, hey, we have a public health crisis. This pandemic is ongoing and getting worse. Do this now. The difference between a suggestion and a mandate.
I think, wanted an order. You wanted a direct
give it to
order.
Me. Yeah, that's right.
Really?
Point and go do
you
this.
You do understand
and like,
why Inslee's not giving a direct order.
Of course. He's,
because he doesn't want to be burned in effigy
yeah,
in every county.
That's right. He's got to get elected again.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand that. But like at some point, you have to put politics aside and address like what is quickly spinning out of control yet again. Do you really want to have to go back to shutting down businesses and go through all that again that was so difficult about last year? One of my, if you count filling in here at Cairo occasionally as a job, I currently have three jobs, mm-hmm. and one of them is a bartender. And I've had to start, not had to, but I've started wearing my mask again. And it I see people come in and it's not required. So it's like, well, if you want to, I've told everyone, do we still have to wear masks? They see me with mine. No, it's not required, but if you want to, you can. Not one person has gone, oh, okay, and put a mask on. And it just confuddles me that here we are again. That's just...
Well, it doesn't baffle me. I can see exactly how this thing has progressed. And I think at this point, the reason that you're not seeing a mandate now, whereas you did a year ago, is because there is a vaccine. Mm-hmm. And I think politicians have come correctly to the conclusion that people who really want to protect themselves now have an easy option. You can walk in right now to a pharmacy and they will stick the thing in your arm, no questions asked. And once you let it sit for a couple of weeks, you're protected. And when you mm-hmm. get the second one, you're protected even more. So now that it's become a matter of personal choice, they can't see what the upside for them. Yes, it's political, but they can't see the upside for them in saying, you must do this or else. What? Because what's the or else? They're not going to go arresting people
yeah,
who
no,
aren't vaccinated.
No, right? Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely not. No, it. I don't know, Dave. Like, it doesn't... personal choice and this will protect you is one thing, but this is an issue that's bigger than you. And I am someone who is vaccinated and has had COVID. So I'm like invincible, right? I'm fine.
Well, you're 95% invincible.
95% invincible. Yeah, that is correct. Yes. Statistically, yes, yeah. Absolutely. But I'm pretty good to go. I'm not worried about catching it, but I can still transmit it. It's not just about
yes.
you. It's about everyone else. It's about the people who cannot get this vaccine.
Well, that's the other thing. Now you're playing to altruism, which is really out of style.
That's
wake
the
up,
problem.
Man.
I know.
I mean, the problem is children, right? There are still people who can't get vaccinated, including children. I don't think they've approved. Have they ever approved it for 12 and up?
No, not that I'm aware of. No.
So that's the vulnerable group now. So but that's going to be on parents, right? You're going to have to bird dog your kids and make sure they're not in the presence of somebody who hasn't been vaccinated. And actually, as you point out, because I think the research has pointed this out, too, the vaccination certainly prevents you from getting sick enough to be hospitalized.
Correct.
In most cases, but that doesn't mean you don't have the virus, and it
right.
doesn't mean you're not spreading the virus.
Correct.
There's such a thing as a carrier. We've known about that since we first started studying infectious diseases.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
That's the reason for the masks. There's nothing baffling to me about that. What's baffling to me is that people are baffled, Aaron.
Well, this is America, Dave. There's nothing we will not let baffle us. That's right. No, if you look around the world, if you look at countries in Asia where there is incredibly dense population, but they have this sort of cultural this normality about wearing masks around, you see that number. That does help. That does keep this thing at bay until we can hopefully get enough people vaccinated.
Aaron Mason joins Ursula this morning at 9, and I think it's great you have 3 jobs. You are a go-getter.
Yeah, that's it. Go get that rent check.
You don't
check.
Also have 8 kids or something, do you?
No, sir.
Okay, just the 3 jobs. Good.
For the good of everyone.
You want to keep that work-life balance. Seattle residents will have a chance to vote on an initiative that would force the city council to provide housing for the homeless and then would require that parks and sidewalks be kept clear of camps, period. Let's go to Cairo's Hannah Scott. So it has qualified. It's going to be on the ballot.
That is right. We just got this word yesterday, and Compassion Seattle, which is the group behind this Charter Amendment 29, I believe it's called, they got the good news on Monday night. This is Erin Goodman with the Soto Business Improvement District. She's one of the business entities that's part of Compassion Seattle, along with some homeless advocates. And she said this is really a pretty significant win for them to get it to the ballot because they had not a lot of time.
We had a much shorter time frame for collecting signatures than ever before. And we're collecting signatures in the unprecedented time of COVID. And so while we knew that we had submitted significantly more signatures than needed, we just knew that we were also up against the clock in order to get this certified and back to council so that it could be on the ballot.
So it does have to go to the city council, through the city council, I should say, next week. But it sounds procedural.
So there is a procedural process by which city council has to vote to put it on the ballot. My understanding is that this is a ministerial duty. It's not a vote of their opinion. It's just a vote saying that the citizens' initiative has reached the threshold. So at their Tuesday, August 3rd meeting, they will take action on it.
So it's not about whether they want it on the ballot or not. A couple of interesting nuggets that came out of this. They did have thousands of the signatures they turned in, which was, I think they turned in more than double than needed. But they had thousands of those that were challenged or not accepted. Mm-hmm. And she said the number one reason was...
Well, I mean, they may not live here, but if you spend...
The number one reason was that people didn't live in Seattle, so that's why they couldn't have a say. And so here's her take on that.
Well, I mean, they may not live here, but if you spend your working day here, you spend the better part of your life here, you know, and that's been a challenge for many of, you know, my business owners in Soto and my board members. Their entire life is invested in Seattle, but they have no say in how the politics are the decisions are made in Seattle. No, I mean, right now, it's not, we are not where we should be. And, you know, the entire region is counting on Seattle thriving because it is the, you know, economic engine for this entire state and this region.
And I know you love polling, Dave. The
Yes.
Northwest Progressive Institute had some polling done on this. 61% said they would vote for the charter amendment.
Okay, and that's among Seattle voters.
That's
right?
Likely Seattle voters, yep.
Okay, not just people who work here and don't live here, because as much as they feel ownership of the place, they can't vote.
Right, exactly. That's, yeah, so those are, they didn't count. But it was an interesting thing. I mean, I hear a lot from people who won't go to Seattle anymore who are from here, and they don't, it's not any place they want to take their family or a family that's visiting or whatever it might be. So there's a significant number of those people, I think, that have those concerns as well.
Right. Well, that's not quite fair unless you, I mean, I don't get into Seattle anywhere near as much as I did.
Mm-hmm.
But the few times I've been down in the Capitol Hill area to walk around, it is still a beautiful city.
Absolutely.
Little by little, the boards are coming down from the windows. I would love to be able, I mean, we used to just rent a hotel room
right?
just for the heck of staying downtown, right?
Me too.
To play tourist because it's that kind of city. So I want it to thrive, even though I don't live there. And it sounds to me like, I should ask you. I mean, one of the things I think this charter amendment will do is give some political cover to members of the city council who would like to clear the tents, but who are vulnerable to, you know, having it be their decision and being held politically responsible. Once it's in the charter, it's programmed in, right? They basically have to carry that out. So,
it's compassionate because it's the end. They don't get to do that until they have adequate space to and wraparounds. Like, all these kinds of services have to be in place for them to be able to do that, where they, and it's not sweeps. And that's the one thing that the people behind the charter amendment really want to get out there, is that they say there's a lot of misinformation being kind of thrown out there by some folks. And it's not about homeless camp sweeps. They insist.
Right. And I think there may, I'll ask you this because you're so close to it. Are there people who actually want to see the camps remain as a political statement to demonstrate the flaws of capitalism?
I've run into a couple of folks like that. They're more of the minority voices. It's generally, you've got a large group of people from up to when we were at the protest and we saw the Cal Anderson encampments being cleared out and all of that, down to some of the ones that we've seen at the schools here more recently. Folks that I see outside of those, they're called, I forget what they call themselves, mutual aid people. Mm-hmm. They tell me that this is all still happening, that essentially the city and groups that are clearing the camps are trying to clear the camps are doing it inhumanely, and that's their big gripe, right? They want to make sure that people aren't losing their stuff, and kind of the same stuff we've been hearing all this time. And they present to me that the city, like, there was some protesters that showed up at a thing with the mayor a few weeks ago down in Occidental Square, and I said, what are you doing out here? And they said, the city is still doing these very inhumane sweeping of the camps, and we want to make sure that they don't do that.
Okay, so they're okay with humane sweeping, though.
Yeah, as long as somebody has some place to go and they don't lose their stuff.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Well, that's reasonable. Mm. Hannah Scott. Thanks, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch, who's in for Colleen, and Chris Sullivan. Let's talk with 6th District Congressman Derek Kilmer, because first thing I want to find out is there really going to be an agreement sometime before the end of the month, which I guess gives us 2 days on this infrastructure bill?
It appears white smoke has begun emanating from the United States Senate. Now, we are bicameral legislative branch, and so it obviously the House will need to weigh in on this as well. But listen, it's good news that we're seeing forward motion on infrastructure. I'm very hopeful that we'll see something make it across the finish line here, because we need to. American Society of Civil Engineers graded out American infrastructure at a C-, and we see that in our neck of the woods quite a bit. So here's what we're talking about. You know, in the bill that passed out of the House, the surface transportation bill that passed out of the House, we're talking about funding, as an example, for roads in proximity to Whitman Elementary School and Edison Elementary School in Tacoma, for things like elevated crosswalks and things like that, because once every 8 days, a student at a Tacoma public school has an incident with an automobile. And so when we talk about improving, you know, creating safe routes to schools, that's infrastructure. You know, I was down in Aberdeen, and anybody who's visited Aberdeen or lives in Aberdeen has likely been stuck in traffic as a train rolls through town, and there's not rail separation between the road and the rail. And that creates congestion, and it means that there's not emergency access to the main commercial area there. God forbid if something goes wrong, there are real safety concerns. And so in the House infrastructure bill, in the House transportation bill, we were actually able to include funding for a highway rail separation. That's infrastructure, right? And that's what we're talking about here, and that's why it matters.
Well, there's going to be an argument that this should be a state responsibility. What's the state highway department for, if not to maintain the roads? Why do the feds have to get involved?
To some degree, this is about our national competitiveness. The ability to move people, the ability to move freight, our investments in our ports, all get at issues of American competitiveness. You know, this is about jobs. The other thing that I would mention is, historically, Democrats and Republicans have acknowledged that investments in infrastructure are valuable for two reasons. One, because they put people to work now, and given the strain that our economy has been through over the course of the last year. That's really important. But second, they laid the foundation for economic opportunity over the long haul. You know, the other thing that we've done in this infrastructure package is also try to solve some problems, not just on the state of Washington's nickel. So I introduced an amendment to address culvert removal and replacement and restoration. You know, we've seen, particularly when we had that huge heat wave, you know, we've seen really scary news about the die-off of salmon populations from rising water temperatures. You know, and we know in our region that we've had deteriorating infrastructure and failing culverts that have not just had a negative impact on water quality, but that have threatened salmon. And so in the infrastructure bill, we included a bipartisan amendment to create a new grant program within the USDOT for culvert restoration and providing some money for it, a substantial amount of money for it. So what that means is having the federal government step up and pick up at least some of the tab for these investments is a big deal for taxpayers in our region. It's a big deal for meeting some of the economic needs of our region. And it's a big deal for our environmental value of trying to restore our salmon.
And you're not worried this is going to ignite inflation?
Well, listen, I think everybody's keeping a close eye on the economic analysis. And what we've seen, including an analysis from Moody's just last week, is that the economic upside of this far outweighs the inflationary concerns.
Let's talk about the Recompete Act, which you were sponsoring with a bipartisan group of legislators. And these are grants to what are distressed areas. My question is, again, if these are essentially loans that don't have to be repaid, how do you avoid, A, people possibly abusing it on harebrained businesses that have no chance of succeeding, and also, again, very possibly overheating a local economy?
You know, unlike Seattle, where things are really cooking, there's a whole bunch of communities in our state where the challenge is not growth. The challenge is lack of economic opportunity. There are communities I represent where there's a real fear that the main export is going to be young people. You know, and listen, I grew up on the Olympic Peninsula. I was in high school when the timber industry took it on the chin. And, you know, I saw a lot of my friends' parents lose their jobs and a lot of my neighbors lose their jobs. How do we make sure that we're not leaving entire communities behind in our changing economy? And the Recompete Act that you mentioned, that is a bipartisan bill that I've introduced, is really trying to target three problems as we think about how to engage on this. First, a lot of communities that are struggling just don't have the capacity to navigate the complex, convoluted system of federal grants and loans. You know, most of them don't have grant writers on staff. Two, while a one-off grant is helpful, most of these communities didn't develop these struggles in 1 year, and they're not going to solve them in 1 year. So a more sustained approach, and in our bill, we propose flexible grants over a 10-year period, a sustained approach is needed. And then third, it's important to recognize that different communities have different needs. There are some communities, I was just talking with some folks in Aberdeen. You know, 90% of the property in Aberdeen is in the floodplain. Aberdeen would probably use these dollars to address that. Other communities I represent don't have broadband access or need help with workforce or, you know, heck, brownfield redevelopment is a big deal. You know, my brother worked in a mill in Port Angeles that closed in 1999. And here in 2021, it's still a derelict site behind a chain link fence.
Is there ever a time when we are not going to need economic recovery tools where it will? Because I'm thinking of the free enterprise types listening to us every morning. Will there ever be a time where the market will be healthy enough that good businesses will thrive and bad businesses will wither and everybody who wants a job can get one?
I hope so. I sure hope so. And listen, you know, so where I see a legitimate role for the federal government is to ensure that those ingredients are there. Things like workforce and infrastructure and access to broadband and, you know, roads and bridges. Historically, Democrats and Republicans have been able to agree that there is a legitimate role for government to address those issues so that if someone is an entrepreneur with a cool idea for their business, that they can compete. Part of the rationale behind a proposal like this is to recognize that there are communities that have been left behind. And while many of your listeners may be in communities that are doing very well, I can tell you, as they travel around the state, and certainly as I travel around my district, you know, I think you should have economic opportunity regardless of what zip code you live in.
Sixth District Congressman, Representative Derek Kilmer. Congressman, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
Choke points. And the campaign to perfect I-405 continues, with construction of a new on and off ramp from the freeway set to begin later this year. Chris, where is this going to be?
This is going to be in Totem Lake. One of the places where I just mentioned in my traffic report is sees heavy slowing every day, because if you've gotten off at 124, say, from southbound 405, you know it's kind of a convoluted, you can choose to go to 116th, you can get off at 124th, and there's just a lot of congestion right there, same in the afternoon going the other direction. And that area is really growing, not just commercially but residentially. We've got that big hospital campus there, which continues to see growth. And so the Washington State Transportation is going to give us a new on and off ramp there at 132nd.
There's a lot of congestion right now, specifically at Northeast 124th Street and Northeast 160th Street. So this 132nd project is going to be building a half diamond interchange, which will hopefully reduce some of that pressure at those neighboring interchanges.
The state's Victoria Miller says work will begin later this year to add a new on-ramp from 132nd to northbound 405 and a new off-ramp from southbound 405 to 132nd. This will give people a lot more direct access to the hospital campus in the north end of Totem Lake without having to go all the way down through the congestion there at 124th. So why not put a full interchange with complete on and off-ramps there, a full diamond, as we like to call it? Miller says the 405 express toll lanes kind of gobbled up the space.
There isn't enough room because of the direct access ramps at Northeast 128th. So there isn't enough room to build a full interchange. But the half diamond will complement the other half diamond interchange down at Northeast 116th.
So this is kind of what we've seen from the DOT over the last couple of years, where they do these smaller projects where they have a little bit of space to try something different, maybe not a full project to alleviate congestion. And that's just kind of the way they're doing it, as they deal with limited space.
We're just trying to find any way to make improvements where there's issues. We're monitoring anything that goes along the corridor. So this is just another improvement that hopefully will be a really big help.
It's a $50 million project. It's fully funded. The new interchange should be open in 2024.
That sounds like pretty good news. And this is being paid for by?
It was Connecting Washington. It was from the 2015 package.
Wow.
So that's why it's fully funded. It's just taken a little while for the funds to come due and the scheduling. So, this is a go regardless of what they're doing with the transportation package that they're trying to pass now in the legislature.
A little while in this case, meaning 6 years, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's the way. I mean, people always ask me, why didn't we do all this construction during COVID? I'm like, it doesn't work that way. The money isn't in the pot yet. You know, they schedule these things out. You can't just flip the switch and do these things. They're scheduled so that the tax revenue comes in, fills up the particular pot, and then you can go forward. So
just a reminder, the best time to plan the projects you want is to do it 6 years before you want it.
Exactly. Okay. And to know 15 years in advance before how many people are going to move here,
exactly.
Which is why they do 40-year modeling. And in case you're wondering, more people are moving here. Shh,
really?
Don't tell anybody.
Still?
Yeah. Shh, okay. Yeah. Don't tell anybody. You can ring my bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch, who's in for Colleen, and Chris Sullivan. What to do with your unused backyard pool? Rachel Bell has the answer to that, don't you?
Yes, I do. There is nothing these days that you can't rent out. Was it my grammar correct on that? That
yes,
you can't not rent
perfect.
Out? Okay, I got it the first time. I will proceed. There's a story in the Wall Street Journal about a service that is like Airbnb for pools. It's not owned by Airbnb. It's called Swimply. And it starts with a story of a guy who lives in Portland, Oregon. He built a pool in his backyard 8 years ago, but he hasn't used it in 2 years since his daughter left and moved out. So with Swimply, which he discovered last fall, he put it up just like you would put up a house on Airbnb. And within the first 2 hours, he booked three groups of people who wanted to come over and swim. And he says in less than a year, he's hosted 2,700 guests in his backyard. $111,000, which covers the cost of the pool, which costs $110,000. And he is one of 13,000 people across the country who are letting people come over to use their pool to make some money. So it says hosts on average earn between $5,000 and $10,000 a month. Most people charge about $35 to $50 an hour. And they said, it's not easy. You got to put the towels out. You got to keep it chlorinated. But like, yeah, that sounds like a pretty easy thing to do to make $111,000. Like you could quit your job to clean the pool.
It depends on how attentive you have to be to your guest. Is this like a full service thing where you do supply the towels and snacks and, I don't know, tanning oil?
I'm assuming that just like Airbnb, you can, you know, say we have this or we don't have this, and that is included in the price. I think, you know, just like Airbnb, it's mostly you're on your own. I wouldn't imagine that you'd have to cater the event, and, you know, you could, maybe you have to bring towels for people. I don't know. I think that the hard part would be if you aren't, you know, wealthy enough to have like a pool house or a well-placed bathroom so people don't have to go through your house. This is like a pretty invasive form of Airbnb because it says 80% of the homeowners choose to be home because they want to make sure that, you know, that people don't get too loud because there's neighbors next door and that they're not, you know, getting drunk. They're not going to step on all the plants. So, you know, you have to be okay with people coming in your house and sitting on your toilet with their wet butt.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you've got to have a place for people to use the bathroom and changing rooms. But here's the other concern I would have, because where we grew up, and this is once again a factor in my privileged upbringing, both of our neighbors had pools, and we were allowed to go over there whenever we wanted to take a swim. And I would really resent it if the only way I could do that would be to book the neighbor's pool through some kind of, what is it, Swimly, Swimplify? What was it?
Swimply. I think Swimply. The P is very strange. I think Swimly would have been better, but, you know, yeah. I don't make the rules. Yeah. Swimply. I mean, yeah, maybe you would have been grandfathered in as a special guest, yeah, but then okay. You would have only been able to come over when the pool wasn't being used by a bunch of frat guys from Ithaca College upstate from you.
Yeah, right. Okay, well.
I would totally use this because there have been many times in the years I've lived in Seattle that I have wanted to swim in a pool because I'm from California. So that's what summers always were, was like, you know, your summers are spent swimming. And here in the city, there are only two outdoor pools. So if you choose to go to those on a weekend, they are just full of children and the pee-pee that comes with them. So like I've rented an Airbnb that had a pool because I wanted to swim so badly. I stayed a night in a hotel once just so I could use the pool. But this would be better. This would be more fun because you would be in someone's yard and presumably you would have like a nice loungy atmosphere.
Yes.
And well, you have it to yourself.
Yeah. Well, I don't have a swimming pool to rent, but I do have a pool table, which I haven't used in 29 years,
You can rent anything, Dave.
Which I'd love to make some money off of. So maybe I'll consider a service called Poolify.
No, it has to be called Poolply.
Poolply?
If this is Swimply, yours is Billiards Plea.
That's it.
Poolply.
Billiardify. Never mind. Yeah. I'm keeping my pool table to myself.
You know what? We're going to have our weekly brainstorming meeting after this to come up with fun names like we always do. We'll work on this one.
Yeah. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave Plea.
Rachel is sponsored by Chevrolet Buick GMC of Puyallup. Any present company have a swimming pool they're looking to rent out?
I do not, but I have an unlandscaped backyard. If anyone wants to go to town back there, it's, you know, could be yours for a small fee.
We've got a retention pond.
Oh, that's cool.
Right
that's
behind.
Pretty good.
Yeah, but it's, you know, full of all sorts of plants and ducks.
Well, yeah, but that's for people
and,
who want a natural aquatic experience.
Yeah, it's more like a spa. I could probably charge more for that because it's kind of like a natural spring.
How big is it?
I like that. Oh, it's huge. I mean, it's a double. It's probably about a quarter mile long.
Wow.
So,
and is it only full after it rains or what?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, right now there's a lot of frogs and toads and ducks and really nice birds.
Well, heck, that is it. What you've got there is like a tropical nature preserve, a resort. You could rent it out to snorkelers.
Well, it's not that deep. I mean, it's probably only about 18 inches deep right now. But by the way, Dave, they already have a couple of things for your pool table. If you wanted to get rid of it, I've heard of this thing called garage sales. And also, I've heard of eBay.
My secret plan is to become really good at it and become a pool shark and then invite unsuspecting neighbors over to lay some money down. Because I'm, you know, I really don't come across as a pool shark. You know, it's a very self-effacing personality. So I figure I could really gull some people and maybe do a second side gig like Aaron Mason does.
You want to be a hustler.
Yeah, exactly. I would like to be a hustler. But
well,
first,
let's trim some marks. We got to trim some marks.
Trimming some marks. I'll write that down.
Isn't that the proper lingo? I don't know.
I have no idea, but I'll need some phrases to bat around so I can really impress people.
You guys got to work on this one.
Trim some marks. Got it. Yeah. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.